So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about our complementary methods with our available for neutron scanner. So most of my I'll spend most of my time explaining neutron scattering techniques, but I will also show you some of the non-neutron methods as well. I know Antonio has gone through basics of scattering already, but I will just remind you what is important for this talk, and this will be a nice reminder for you for this morning. So there are two types of neutron scattering. One of them is elastic neutron scattering. In this type of scattering, there is no exchange of energy between a neutron and your sample, and we simply study change in momentum or direction of the neutron. The second type is elastic neutron scattering. In this, we study both changes in energy as well as change in momentum or direction. And you get a scattering vector Q is defined as A minus K prime, and you can calculate its value using the triangle, which you have already seen. So what exactly do we measure in a neutron scattering experiment? So the measurable quantity in a neutron scattering experiment is double differential scattering cross-section. And as you can see, this depends on what we call dynamic structure factor, ST omega. And this is sample dependent. So this is the one that gives us information about structure as well as our dynamic structure sample. Now, this can readily be broken into coherent and incoherent dynamic structure factors using these equations, which you have already seen. So now, so what are these coherent and incoherent dynamic structure factors? So as you can see, we have dynamic structure factors, incoherent and coherent. If you perform Fourier transform, then you go from omega space or frequency space to time space, and we end up having what we call intermediate scattering function. This is what we measure directly on neutron scattering spectrometer. If we perform Fourier transform one more time, then we go from Q space to R space. These are called correlation functions. So as you can see, if in a neutron scattering experiment you are measuring S incoherent Q omega, you are simply studying self-correlation function. Same way, if you are measuring S coherent Q omega, then you are studying pair correlation function. So what are these correlation functions? Self-correlation function is the probability of finding a particle at position r after time t if that same particle was present at position 0 at time. So as you can see, here you are dealing with the same particle, hence the term self-correlation function. Pair correlation function, on the other hand, is the probability of finding a particle at position r after time t if there was a particle at position 0 at time t equals 0. So as you can see, you are not necessarily dealing with the same particle, but rather a pair of particles, hence the term pair correlation function. So how do these dynamic structure factors look like in frequency domain? So here is a sketch of SQ omega. This is plotted as a function of energy transfers. As you know, elastic neutron scattering, energy transfer is zero. And this appears as a sharp peak at zero energy transfer. This also gives you an idea about instrument position. The second type is quasi-elastic neutron scattering. This also peaks at zero energy transfer, but this, as you can see, is broadened with respect to instrument position. Now, this broadening arises due to diffusive or diffusive light motion. So this is the type of scattering you will see in this talk. The third type is inelastic neutron scattering, in which there is a peak at non-zero energy transfers, meaning at fixed frequencies. So this type of scattering reflects vibrational or fast motion system. So here we are looking at same sketch of SQ omega, but now we are extending to much higher energy transfer. So again, at omega equals zero, we have elastic scattering. And on the top of that, we have quasi-elastic neutron scattering. Now, if we go towards high energy transport, then we get to see coherent inelastic scattering, which is basically a collective vibration of atoms in a lattice. If you keep going further, like hundreds of millielectron volts, then you get to see incoherent inelastic scattering due to molecular vibrations. Now, the important thing is that you can access all of this by using typical spectrometers that are available at major facilities. And some of them you are going to see this afternoon. So now we know the concept of drawing. So what can be done? So this is the Fick's law, and GSRD is the solution of the equation, which simply is diffusion of a particle. So here is the self correlation function form for this. Here, important thing to notice is D is the diffusion coefficient of this diffusing particle. If we perform Fourier transform, then we end up having functional form for intermediate scattering function in time domain. If you perform Fourier transform one more time, then we go from T space to omega space, and we end up with a functional form for ST omega, we call it Lorentzian function. So now the important thing to remember here is that this gamma here is nothing but full width half max of that dot. And for simple diffusion, it is D times Q square. So as you can see, by measuring Q dependence of that dot, you can calculate diffusion coefficient of that diffusing particle. So here I'm showing a sketch for two Q values. As you can see, the broadening is smaller for lower Q values. And then when you go towards higher Q values, you can see broadening increase. So by measuring its Q dependence, we can determine diffusion coefficient. So now, can we learn more from this broadening? Yes, we can. So here I'm showing a functional form for full width half max or half width half max as a function of Q for three different models. Now, these models assume that diffusion is not continuous, but rather it occurs in a small jumps. That's why we call them jump diffusion models. So the top one here is Chadli Eliot model. This model assumes that this diffusion occurs in a small step, but of fixed length R. Because here we are dealing with fixed length R, this type of model works better for crystalline materials or lattices where distances are fixed. Now, for soft matter, of course, there is going to be a distribution of jump lengths due to amorphous nature of materials. So the last two models deal with that exactly. So here we have Hall and Gross model. This model assumes that these jump lengths, they have a Gaussian distribution around mean position R0. And as you can see, there is this function form. The third one is SS model that assumes that these distribution of jump lengths is exponential. As you can see, they all have a distinctive Q dependence of full width half max. So by measuring full width half, so by measuring broadening and by modeling its Q dependence, you can determine exactly what type of discrete diffusion process it is. Now, by fitting the broadening data, we also get one more important parameter, so elastic and coherent structure factor. This is simply the ratio of total elastic signal over total signal. Now, you can see it also has a very distinctive Q dependence, and by modeling Q dependence, we can figure out the exact geometry of that diffusion, where the diffusion is taking place. So here we are considering in this example that we the diffusion is occurring on any incurrent sites that are that are located on a circle. So for n equals 2, it's dumbbell type of motion. For n equals 3, it's going to be a three-side jump like you would expect from a Mayfield rotation and so on. As you can see, EISF has this distinctive form again for all of these models. So by modeling EISF as a function of Q, we can determine exactly the geometry of that restrictive diffusion. Okay, so now we are going to choose a spectrometer. So what are the complementary neutron scattering techniques you are going to see in this talk today? So one of them is time of flight, and the other one is light scattering. As you can see, the neutron spinnaker has access to a larger length scale, as well as smaller energy transfer, meaning longer time. Time of flight, on the other hand, has access to relatively shorter length scale, as well as faster time scale. So, and backscattering sits somewhere in between. Now, time of flight and backscattering, they are optimized to measure incoherent scattering, while neutron spinnaker is optimized to measure coherent scattering. However, all of these techniques can measure the other type of scattering as well. So how do we make sure what we want to measure and how we do it? So, let's look at the advantage or disadvantage of hydrogen. So here I'm showing incoherent and coherent scattering for typical elements that you would find in soft matter. As you can see, hydrogen has very large incoherent scattering cross section. That means if your sample has hydrogens in it, then most of the scattering will be incoherent scattering on those hydrogens. If you don't want to see that, then what you can do is you can substitute hydrogen with deuterium, and then the scattering will be dominated by coherent scattering from deuterium and hydrogen. This also makes this technique selective, because for example, if you are interested in a polymer blend or a mixture of liquids, and you are interested in set correlation motion from one of the components, then you can leave that one hydrogenated and you can deuterate the other one and you won't see it. Okay, so now we are really ready to build a spectrometer. So how do we do this? So before we do this, let's have a look at the instrument resolution and why this is. Instrument resolution is nothing but full width half max elastic response. And this basically gives us an idea about the slower dynamics that we can resolve. Dynamic range, on the other hand, is the energy exchange range that is available on this is shown here as on by x-axis. So that range gives you an idea about faster dynamics that you can analyze. Now, typically for neutron spectrometers, dynamic range is like 2 to 3 orders over instrument resolution. So imagine you have a process that has filled with half max of 20 micro E. Then the new instrument is going to work very nicely because it can resolve it, as well as the dynamic range offered by this can contain it. However, if you try to measure this on this, say, wet instrument, then it will simply be buried within the elastic line and you won't be able to see it. Same way, if you have a process that has 100 micro E for the half max, we better measure it either on red or green instrument, because if we try to measure it here, then dynamic range offered by this instrument will not be able to contain it, and it will simply appear as flat background. Okay, so how do we do blue instrument, meaning an instrument with very fine instrument resolution? So here I'm showing two instruments that are available here in the United States. The top one is high flux backscattering, you will see it this afternoon. And the bottom one is called backscattering silicon spectrometer. It is located at SNS in Tennessee. So how do we achieve higher resolution at backscattering? So we do this by using silicon 111 crystals. So here is the spreading wavelength for a black that we need from. Theta here is the angle, and D is the internal space. So as you can see, if we choose 2 theta to be 180 degrees, then this term will disappear, and we can achieve smaller spread in wavelength and increase the instrument resolution. Because 2 theta is 180 degrees, hence the term back step. So here you can see a monochromator and fiber, they are made of silicon 111 crystals. And by doing this, we can achieve a fine resolution of 0.8 micro EV. In time, this would be about 2 nanoseconds. And the dynamic range offer on this instrument is plus minus 36 microfarads. Now, this instrument here is a near backscattering spectrometer, and it is based on time of flight concept. So here's its instrument resolution equation. Delta TP is as rate of the neutron, and T0 is time of flight of that neutron. So as you can see, if you want to minimize delta E, then you have to use longer T0 values. Many, you have to use longer neutron, right? This is the reason that this instrument is located on a very long neutron guide. And by doing this, they can achieve a high resolution of 3.5 microEV with a dynamic range of plus minus 100 microEV in standard configuration. So now let's have a look at some of the examples from backscattering. So imagine you have an interesting and a very important sample, such as DNPC membrane. And you want to get quick information about its dynamics as well as any phase transition. So what we can do is we can measure what we call elastic intensity on backscattering as a function of temperature. So what you see here is that from low temperature side, as you increase the temperature, intensity goes down slowly. And that is due to vibrational motion. Now at 287 Kelvin, you see a small step. This step is due to a phase transition in the DNPC where it goes from older gel phase to the liquid phase. If you keep increasing temperature, then you see another, but larger step this time at 297 Kelvin. And this is due to another phase transition in which DNPC goes from liquid phase to fluid phase where all chains are dissolved. So in this example here, we are looking at the effects of aspirin when it is incorporated into DNPC. So why we are doing this experiment? We are doing this experiment because we know that these drugs, all NSAIDs, these are very important drugs. We use them every day, but they also have side effects. And we know that their beneficial actions as well as their side effects, they have something to do with how these drugs interact on cell membrane level. So this is what we are trying to mimic here. So again, elastic intensity as a function of temperature. This is for neat DNPC, which you just saw on previous slide. And this is the elastic scan for DNPC plus aspirin. There are two things you would notice here. Number one, transition at 288 Kelvin has disappeared. What this means is that incorporation of aspirin completely inhibits ordered gel phase in DNPC. The second thing you would notice is that this transition has been pushed towards lower temperature as well as it is broader. What this means is that incorporation of aspirin into DNPC increases its fluidity. Now, dynamics of a membrane is very complex because it exhibits a number of motions, for example, vibrational, conformational, flip-flop motion, as well as the lateral motion of leaflet and internal motion, as well as whole bilayer motions, for example, bending motions and concentration fluctuations. So by using quasi-elastic neutron scattering, we can access lateral diffusion as well as internal motion of a So these measurements were made on basis spectrometers. So this is lateral diffusion coefficient of a leaflet as a function of aspirin. So as you can see, incorporation of aspirin simply speeds up lateral diffusion of a leaflet. And this is much more pronounced at 280 Kelvin. As you can see, it changes almost by a factor of two. Same thing can be seen with the internal motions where you see stronger effects. So this is what we have. For neat DNPC, in the ordered gel phase, all chains are ordered, they are slightly tilted, and they are in transform. When we heat it up, and when we go above that small transition, a ripple of gauge defects set in. And that is why we call it ripple form. Then finally, when we go above the transition, all chains have Gauche defects and DNPC membrane is disordered. Now, when we incorporate aspirin into it, even below pre-transition temperature, DNPC membrane is disordered and there are Gauche defects as well as is a lateral motion and internal motion, they speed it up if you compare it with medial velocity. When we increase the temperature, basically all DMPC is disordered and all chains have Gauss defect. Now we also made this transfer of resonance on it, and we can calculate its bending rigidity. So by incorporation of aspirin, bending rigidity goes down. So basically, membrane becomes much softer. So now, as you can see, when we incorporate aspirin into the DMPC, its basic dynamics changes. So it is really important when we are considering its beneficial action as well as side effects, we have to consider its dynamic action. So here is my second example. In this example here, we are looking at gas diffusivity in grafted nanoparticles, and we are trying to relate it to the local polymer dynamics. So the polymer here is polymethyl ethylene, and we also have its grafted nanoparticles made with silica core. So here is the diffusivity of CO2 and CH4, which is plotted as a function of molecular weight. This line represents one, and as you can see, this diffusivity is normalized to corresponding polymer. You can see all of these values are larger than or more than one. That means diffusivity of gases speeds up for all molecular weight ranges, but which is especially dramatic around 90. So why does that happen? So they wanted to find this, and we made our backscatter model from this. So here you can see the backscatter data broadening because of grafted nanoparticles, and the black symbol here because of polymer. As you can see, grafted chains are faster. So we can print this data, and we can calculate relaxation times again. So here these are relaxation times for grafted chains. Again, they are normalized to corresponding polymer, not as a function of molecular weight. So what we see is that all of them are smaller than one, meaning all grafted nanoparticles are faster if you compare them with their corresponding polymer. And you also see it there. So you can see this better here. Again, the red symbol here, diffusivity of CO2 normalized to corresponding polymer as a function of molecular weight shows a peak. Now, if you look at the here is the diffusion coefficient for grafted chain, again normalized to polymer, and this also shows the peak. Now, very similar behavior, but they do not peak exactly at the same molecular weight. Now, this could be due to a number of reasons, and one of them is that these measurements were made at different temperatures. So diffusivity was measured at room temperature, while polymer dynamics was measured at 420 Kelvin to bring it into backscattering time window. This one here shows local free volume, which is measured by pulse as a function of molecular weight. You again see that in this molecular weight range, there is an excess of local free volume. And here we are plotting jump lengths that were calculated by fitting the data to appropriate polymer models as a function of molecular weight. And what you see here is that there is a peak in jump length as a function of molecular weight in the same molecular weight range. What this means is that there is an additional relaxation of in this molecular weight. And that assists gas transport in these grafted nanoparticles. So this is the situation we have. At low molecular weights, when chains are short, system is dense and it does not want to interdigitate. But at the same time, system has to keep or maintain roughly the same polymer density everywhere. So these two contrasting demanding situations lead to a situation where there is an excess of molar volume of polymer chains, and we have liquid like that. That's where we have a peak in local free volume, meaning there's an extra local free volume, as well as find that there is an additional relaxation hub that is assisting gas diffusion. Now, when we go towards higher molecular weights, now we are far away from our silicon nanoparticle surface, so there is a lot of space. Now, chains can interdigitate, and the extra local free volume goes down, and we are back to the polymer situation. Okay, so now let's have a look at some of the basic concepts of time of flight. Now, if we can measure a neutron time of flight very accurately, then we can determine exactly how much time it has exchanged with the sample. Now, to be able to determine this time of flight accurately, we have to do one of the two things. Number one, we can label a neutron, then we know where it is at some point of time. Unfortunately, we can't do that. So the second thing that we can do is we can introduce pulse nature to the neutron. Then we know where all the neutrons are at some point of time. And that is what we can easily do by using these rotating disks. So neutrons pass through only from these from here. And these disks rotate at very high speed. So for example, a DCS instrument, which you will see this afternoon, they rotate at 20,000 RPM. So by doing this, we can get a pulse neutron. Now, to get a nice and uniform monochromatic beam is not straightforward. So we have to use a bunch of these choppers. So as you can see, we have pulsing choppers. These are counter-rotation disks. Then frame removal chopper, then ordinary chopper, and finally, monochromatic chopper. So by using these disks, we can get a very nice and uniform pulse beam. So here is the energy resolution equation for a time of flight. As you can see, instrument resolution depends on neutron. So if you want to achieve higher resolution, you have to use longer neutron wavelengths. And by changing this wavelength, you can also achieve different resolution that suits your study. So here is a sketch of time of flight. So this is distance as a function of time. So imagine you have a nice and uniform beam passing through one beam chopper, it goes and hits the sample. So now in this sample, this neutron gets lost in the static in the sequence sample. However, if it loses energy, then the neutron wavelength is going to be longer, and it will take longer to be detected by the sample. Same way, if it gains some energy, then the wavelength is going to be shorter, and it will be detected rather quickly. So we know all of these distances, and by measuring this time of flight, we can exactly figure out how much energy we have consumed. So let's have a look at some of the examples from time of flight. So here we are dealing with polymer membranes for gas separation. So when you are considering a polymer membrane for a gas separation, you have to consider two things. Number one, a four-way polymer membrane should be able to select the gas you are trying to separate. The second one is you also have to look at the effects of aging on your polymer membrane. Now, this densification we can easily access by neutron scattering in terms of what we call boson beta. So here we have two systems. One of them is metrimate. This is a standard gas separation polymer membrane. And then the second one, there's a newer one, it's called PMM1. So here we are showing vibrational density of states J omega. Now this can easily be calculated from SQ omega as a function of frequency omega. So what you see here is that you see some peaks. Now these peaks we call boson peaks. Now to be able to measure boson peak, you have to make measurements at very low temperature, because if there is any elastic broadening, then you will not be able to see these peaks clearly. So these measurements are typically made at very low temperatures. So what you see here is that boson peak for PIM1 shows up at lower frequency. So what this means is that this material is softer on molecular level if you compare it with metrimate. Now this is a bit surprising, because if you look at the monomer of PIM1, it has absolutely no degrees of freedom. On the other hand, if you look at metrimate, it certainly has at least rotational degrees of freedom. So how come this material is softer and not this? So they made some more measurements, and what they found out finally, that these stiff PIM chains, they cause early solidification of structure, which leads to an open sponge-like structure. And it offers higher compressibility and hence softness on molecular level, which we see in boson peak. So here, We are looking at CO2 absorption as a function of aging time. As you can see, the aging CO2 absorption goes down. So why does that happen? So again, we look at boson peak data for a freshly prepared PIM sample and an aged sample. As you can clearly see that in aged sample, boson peak moves towards higher frequencies, meaning this material becomes harder on molecular. And that's why it is less, it becomes less and less efficient with aging. Okay, so here is another example. In this example, we are looking at sub-nano relaxation in polymer glasses, and we are trying to establish a relationship with mechanical toughness. So the polymer here is polycarbonate. Polycarbonate is an excellent polymer because it offers very high impact strength, as you can see through ISO impact here, very high number. So what we can do is we can change this mechanical toughness systematically in polycarbonate, either by blending it with aeroflow or by introducing 1,4 cyclohexyl chain directly into the melt chain. So we made elastic scan measurements on these two systems. Here is the mean square displacement plotted as a function of temperature. Now, mean square displacement can be calculated from the elastic scan that I showed earlier for DMPC by using this equation. And this mean square displacement gives us an idea about molecular mobility. So as you can see, mean square displacement is a function of temperature for airflow system. As we increase the temperature from low temperature side, mean square displacement increases linearly subgently. That is consistent with harmonic oscillator of motion of atoms around a fixed position. So this basically gives us an idea about vibrational stiffness of these materials. So you can see they all are pretty much the same. Now, above 200 Kelvin, mean square displacement shows enough time, meaning there is an additional dynamics. So what we can do is we can measure this excess mean square displacement. This is what we have here. And we can plot this as a function of impact parameters. Now, this one is normalized to corresponding to polycarbonate. So polycarbonate, of course, sits at one. Aeroflow is down here. And DXCY, one of them is down here, but then two of them are there. So what you see here is that there's a clear correlation between this excess mean square displacement and ISO impact, meaning higher the excess mean square displacement is, tougher the material. So now, can we find out from where this excess mean square displacement is coming? Right? There is an additional dynamics. Yes, we can. So here we have a different system, but very similar. So here we have polycarbonate, and now we have tetrahedrate when we put it in. And we have full comprehensive measurement on this system by using time of flight in the temperature range where we saw. Excess mean square displacement. So you can see here, this is at low temperature, 130 Kelvin. I'm pretty sure you recognize this by now, which is boson peak. But then this boson peak simply merges into elastic line, meaning there is no quasi elastic relaxation or broadening. However, at higher temperature side, you can clearly see there is huge quasi elastic broadening and also signs of boson peak. So on the right hand side here, we are calling peak amplitude, meaning how strong the process is as a function of temperature. So you can see boson peak retains intensity, same intensity in the entire temperature range. However, if you look at the quasi elastic relaxation, they are very weak in the low temperature side, but then they go. What is interesting here is that the temperature where boson peak crosses with quasi elastic relaxation, that's the temperature base where we seem to get excess mean square displacement, as well as there's a transition in the material when it goes from brittle to ductile model. So what happens here is that at higher temperatures, materials are able to dissipate energy via these quasi elastic relaxation. However, when we are at lower temperature side, materials are not able to dissipate energy because these quasi-elastic relaxations are completely absent or very weak, and material becomes brittle and it breaks. Okay, so now I am going to show you two non-neutron methods. So the first one is molecular dynamic simulation. Molecular dynamic simulation go together with neutron scattering very well, because in molecular dynamic simulations, as you know, we know the position of atoms at all times. So we can calculate any type of correlation function for any types of atoms. So this is a major advantage over neutron scattering, where measuring different correlation functions is not straightforward, and sometimes it's not even possible. So here we are looking at a system. It's an asymmetric polymer blend where we have PMA. It has TG around 400 Kelvin, and the other component is PEO, which is a semi-crystalline material. It shows a very weak TG at 200 Kelvin. So when we make a blend of 25% of PEO with PMA, PEO remains amorphous at all temperatures. So here in this work, we are looking at dynamics of PEO in this blend. So here are the scattering functions that are calculated as a function of time for hydrogens of PEO. Now, you can see that relaxation of PEO chains is very unusual, because it extends over so many decades of time. So typically, it's much sharper and it decays within few orders of time scale. So here it's extremely spread. Why is that? So here, here is the definition of Lagrange self-correlation function as a function of distance r. So what you see here is, and these are calculated at 400 Kelvin. So what you see here is that they are really broad. And then once you go to say 8 nanoseconds or so, you can clearly see signs of an additional peak. And that does not change with time. And then you have the same peak at 16 nanoseconds as well. So what this additional peak means, which does not change with time, at say tens of nanoseconds, that you have confined localized chains of PEO. Now, why that is happening like this? Because remember, we are at 400 Kelvin, meaning PMMA chains are still rather stiff because we are not too far away from its TG. So this you can see much better here, where these calculations are here at 500 milliseconds. And you can clearly see that now that P is completely gone. So what happened at 500 Kelvin, that now surrounding PMMA chains, because you are like 180 Kelvin above TG of PMA, they are able to move as well. And now PEO chains can completely relax and the confinement effects go away. So we can get this type of insight in the PMMA simulation, and they go really nicely together with, sometimes they help us a lot in interpreting neutron scattering measurements. This is my last slide. So here, I'm showing an example of broadband dielectric spectroscopy. So broadband dielectric spectroscopy also goes very well with neutron scattering. So in dielectric spectroscopy, what we measure is dipolar rotation, and we measure real and imaginary part of dielectric constant. And what is really good with broadband dielectric spectroscopy is that you can cover a very wide frequency range, going almost 10 to the power minus 3 up to 10 to the power 16 hertz, that too in a relatively short time, like in a few days. Using a setup like this shown here, which you can have in the lab. Now, here I'm showing an example where broadband dielectric spectroscopy results and neutron scattering results, and we came to a conclusion. So, here we are looking at dynamics of biomolecules. So these biomolecules are hydrated with D2O. So we're not looking at signal from water. We hydrate them with D2O, so we are looking at the motions of biomolecules. So here are the time scales for tRNA. from neutrons, open symbol, and these are from light one. Now, in early 2000, concept of slaving was introduced. So according to this concept, our dynamics of a hydrated biomolecule was considered to be simply slaved to its hydration water. Now, if that concept is true, then the temperature dependence of these planets should be about the same, because these two samples are prepared for equivalent hydration levels. Now, even from neutron scattering data, you can see that that may not be the case. However, because of the limited time range, as well as large error bars, it's hard to make that claim. So they made measurements using broadband directed spectroscopy. So this may be data from DRM. You can see you have two processes, slow process and fast process is the one that matches neutron scattering as far as time scales go and the spectral shape. And this is the data by design. Now, as you can see, now we have extended frequency range for time range, we can clearly see that they do have separate different temperature dependence. That means concept of slaving doesn't work. So what we proposed to see in this work was that structure of biomolecule itself is really important, and it really can affect the dynamics a lot. So you can see that it's true here, because if you look at time scales from lysozyme and myoglobin, they are very similar, meaning concept of slaving also works. And it is because these two biomolecules are small and globular proteins, and they both have very similar secondary structures, which is made of helices and beta sheets. However, tRNA has very different secondary structure, which is composed of four strands of helices. And because of its very different structure, its dynamics is also very different. So with this, I will stop and I will take any questions if you have.